safe injection sites, having drugs to reduce opioid toxicity available over the counter, and better treatment for the user. Recall the root causes for the Department of Health in Hawaii being political context and governance. Studies relate income inequality to drug use. The root causes of the overdose crisis are not being addressed.
You're listening to Stephen Bezruchka, Inequality Kills Us All. This is Independent Alternative Radio. To get copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
A country that tried to address the root causes of their drug crisis was Portugal. They had followed the pattern established by President Nixon's war on drugs in the 1970s. Drug use increased, and many ended up in prison. In 2000, at a time when the use of heroin in Portugal was the second highest in Europe, they decriminalized all drug consumption. They saw their previous policy dealing with drug use was not working and tried something different, a public health approach. Drug use deaths declined in comparison to what was happening in other European nations. And Portugal is a considered healthier country by vital signs than the United States. If we eliminated all deaths from heart disease and cancer in the U.S., we'd achieve the lifespan of Portuguese. They're doing many things better than we are. Using drugs as a coping mechanism for stress in society has been around for thousands of years. Sigmund Freud, the father of psychoanalysis, used cocaine regularly. So did William Halstead, the pioneer of many surgical operations, who was chief surgeon at the Johns Hopkins Hospital and is considered the father of modern American surgery. So our incredibly high rates of opioid and other drug use can be explained by the social collapse of American society. Loneliness is at an all-time high, and this is at least partly catalyzed by social media, which is something individuals do alone, rather than in a group effort, such as partying or otherwise socializing. Very few cars use the high-occupancy vehicular lanes, and we search for happiness by buying more stuff we don't need. Think of all the implications of this research. We live in a very highly stressed society. The United States has some of the highest stress of all nations. No wonder we use 3/4 of the world's opioids, as well as other drugs that help us cope with the stress we constantly face. Trying to reduce the harm from drug use in America is like addressing Americans being dead first by suggesting the provision of better medical care. Not a bad idea, but it is far from the mark. Healthcare is only a small player in producing good health in a nation. Along with personal health-related behaviors, that's the hardest concept to get Americans to take seriously. Our language defeats us. We invest in health, pay for health, get health, access health, and so on. We conflate health with health care. I recall former Oregon Governor Kitzhaber's phrase, "Do you want health or health care?" In the United States, we don't have either. We spend close to half of the world's health care bill, yet we have perhaps 100 million people who are either uninsured or lack sufficient health care insurance to deal with medical issues. The leading cause of bankruptcy in America has been medical expenses. This is crazy. Another perspective asks why we consume such a large proportion of the world's opioids. We have a great deal of pain in America. There are two kinds of pain, physical pain and social pain. And studies show we have more pain than other countries. The pain of living in such an unequal society is huge. Stress creates social pain. Opioids treat social pain very well. This country has a big hurt we try to cope with. And the opioid delivery industry provides for that need. Instead of having to get your fix in a seedy part of town, delivery is now Uberized. You can get fast relief. Studies show that people living in more unequal countries use more drugs, and hence there are more deaths. Without addressing that inequality, we won't get very far. The other mostly unspoken factor relates to the conditions of early life in America, which I'm coming back to. We've learned that about half of adult health has been programmed during the first 1,000 days after conception. By the time you're blowing out 2 candles on your birthday cake, much of your adult health trajectory has been cast. How do you come to believe such a statement in a country where individual agency is the way to succeed? Using this advice requires us to choose our parents well. Before we're conceived, make sure your mother and father own their own home. Be sure your parents aren't poor. Of course, there are stories of individuals who grew up enduring the shackles of poverty, but broke them and became billionaires. Recent studies have found that white, middle-aged folk, especially those without college degrees, are dying from deaths of despair. They believed in the American dream, the rags-to-riches transformation. But by around age 50, they realized this wasn't going to happen. The response was to use drugs, alcohol, and commit suicide. This phenomenon wasn't seen in other rich nations. Recall, we're one of 2 countries without a national policy of paid maternity leave. Under the conditions of the Family Medical Leave Act, passed in 1993, you're entitled to unpaid leave for 4 months. Your employer will hold your job for that period. But only the well-to-do can take such a leave to care for their infant. So this factor drives up our infant mortality. All the other rich countries offer paid leave during pregnancy, as well as do some states such as California and Washington. We need a national policy. One way to look at what countries do to support early life is to see how much money a nation spends on each year of life. Sweden, a very healthy country, spends more government money on the first year of life than in any subsequent year. We spend our money on remedial actions for a delinquent child after they enter school. We have no national policy for paid preschool, paid daycare, and many other expenses that must be spent to raise a child. Again, in contrast to other rich countries. One other critical issue relates to bad things that happen during childhood. They're called ACEs, or adverse childhood experiences. Studies looked at them began in the early 1970s at Kaiser Permanente in San Diego. These are grouped in 10 categories representing neglect as physical and emotional, abuse as emotional, physical, and contact sexual, and household dysfunction, which included the presence of an imprisoned person, mother treated violently, someone being an alcoholic or drug user, someone chronically depressed, suicidal, or in a psychiatric hospital, as well as not being raised by both biological parents. The more ACEs you had as a child, the more likely you were to become a teen parent, use intravenous drugs, take psychotropic medicines for mental illness, attempt suicide, and not live to be very old. ACEs are very common in the United States and are linked to income inequality. Enough of these misfortunes. I was a lone sheep bleating about the bad effects of income inequality around the link to our health over 25 years ago. There wasn't much concern about the gap between the rich and the poor, but that's changed considerably today. And many recognize the bad health effects of early life today. The media report our health decline, too, as well as the poor health outcomes for African Americans and the record-shattering drug overdose death epidemic. These represent giant steps for Americans as we recognize there's not a good morning in America today but smoke from fires. We're always being given health advice. In my book, I lay out tips for better health. They are: be born in a caring, sharing, and repairing society. Nurture strong family and social ties. Don't be poor. Don't have poor parents. Don't work in a stressful, low-paid, and meaningless job. Don't live in a country with high income or wealth inequality, large health inequities, lack of time and resources for parenting, costly, specialized, inaccessible medical care. Whose responsibility is it to put that advice into place? Not you as an individual. Societies need to do this. Can it be done in America? Here I fall back on a concept enunciated by Eugene Debs, the labor leader and presidential candidate back in the 1920s. When asked what his greatest regret was about his lifetime struggle for justice, he replied, "I regret that the American people can have almost anything they want under our Constitution, but they seem to not want much of anything at all." We have the power to create the society where good health is a natural outcome, something that doesn't depend on what we do personally to achieve well-being. We could smoke just like they do in Japan, yet not die from smoking-related diseases. Japan's a very especially interesting case study. At the end of the Second World War, we had destroyed Japan. With our occupation, we rebuilt the country. There were three main features in that process. We forbade Japan to have an army. Article 9 of the Constitution said they had to resolve all disputes peacefully. We put Article 23 into the Constitution, making the government responsible for making the public healthy. We decreased the huge inequality present there by legislating a maximum wage and by the most successful land redistribution program in world history. From a life expectancy estimate of 24 years in 1945, Japan saw the most rapid mortality decline ever. By 1978, it became the longest-lived country. This tested medicine works. We could either ask Japan to return the favor or give the magic medicine to us, or we could prescribe it to ourselves. Our democracy allows this. But it won't happen until we recognize that good health escapes us and that medicine we need is what we administered to Japan. Now that I've completely depressed you, what am I going to offer for relief? What steps can you take so we're not dead first? The last chapter of the book describes various ways to make America healthy again. To begin with, you should do what you enjoy. If you don't enjoy doing something, it becomes an onerous task that won't last long. Do what you can do for a long period of time without requiring much money. I've been lucky that I could fund my habit by playing doctor for income, and many others have occupations to sustain them. Recognize that we have power as citizens in America. The most common way people give up their power is thinking they don't have any. There are strong forces at work to make us feel powerless. Working together, we the people can produce good health in America. What can one person do? Don't be one person. The African proverb speaks to this. If you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. We must organize or die. As a teacher, I develop curriculums around the ideas in the book and require students to do community outreach exercises. If I told you to convene a community meeting and present what I've been talking about, few would. But if this is a requirement for completing a course and getting a grade, it gets done. So many of the chapters, many of the concepts in Chapter 10 stem from what my students have taught me. As an employee, talk about these ideas at work. If you're an employer, convene a lunch meeting to discuss our health. If you belong to a labor union, there are many possibilities for engaging others. If you work in some segment of healthcare, talk about this to patients, their families, and co-workers. When I worked as an emergency physician, I would bring up population health ideas with patients and others I interacted with. Doing so gave me skills at presenting various ideas to different people. Develop skills to talk about what you've heard tonight. My students have to craft elevator speeches, the kind of 10, 20 to 20 second effort you can make while the elevator is going up or down. I tell them to practice their speech around dinner time when they receive a marketing call that is being recorded for quality assurance purposes. That means the caller won't hang up. There are many TEDx talks to present at. Meet with your elected representatives to discuss these ideas. They or their staff will meet with you. Be sure to arrive with as many supporters as you can muster. Support various legislative efforts going on by testifying or writing letters to promote bills that will decrease inequality and support early life. Attend public demonstrations and carry a sign about health in America. Even better, be in a group that carries a banner. Write articles for distribution on social media, newspapers, and other channels you have access to. YouTube has become a great site for presenting ideas. The same for podcasts. Join organizations working in health and in healthcare. The American Public Health Association is one national organization that has some progressive groups such as the Spirit of 1848 Caucus. The Washington State Medical Association is a local doctor group. The Washington State Public Health Association is another. They have regular conferences that are worth attending. Physicians for a National Health Program is a good group to catalyze with U.S. health status ideas. Social movements such as the Civil Rights Movement and the anti-Vietnam War protests in the 60s were very influential. Today, police killings and abortion issues present opportunity. I take comfort in recognizing that social movements can't be predicted. Society is very fragmented. Indifference abounds. Hope is a discipline. Don't give up hope. 20 years from now, you'll be more disappointed by the things you didn't do than by what you did. It is not enough to know the world. We must change it. If you're not at the table, you might be on the menu. Don't be missing in action. We must make America healthy again. Thank you. Comments, questions?
That was a wonderful talk, Stephen. I'm wondering about the stress and inequality hypothesis, having lived and worked in Japan for a while. Stress is not absent there. There was that pressure of the salaryman trying to make it and kind of rather high suicide rate. So I kind of wonder how you square that with their life expectancy.
So in Japan is a very stressful society. However, everybody is stressed there. And the socioeconomic gradient in health, the low-level manual workers seem to do better than the rich executives. It's kind of a paradox. Japan has many paradoxes as to what produces health. So, yes, they've imported our word and they call it stressoru. Yeah.
Thank you, Stephen. They did a nice study back in the early 2000s comparing wealth and health outcomes in England and here. But they only had diabetes and a couple other outcomes. And I'm curious about the wealthiest in this country actually don't live as long and do as well as other countries, but I haven't ever seen specific studies. This one study I looked at showed quartiles of the poorest in our country are less healthy than the poorest in England, and up to the top, even the wealthiest of the wealthiest. So if you're Bill Gates, you're not safe unless you move to England. But I don't know the data really on it. I'm just saying this one study I saw.
So there are quite a few studies now. The first one was Banks and Marmots, in published about 1996, comparing disease in England and disease here. And England did far better. A variety of other studies have looked at household wealth and disease mortality in a variety of European countries and the United States. And at all levels, household wealth is much higher here, but we have higher death rates. I think the age segment was 55 to 74, something like that. Many studies attest to the idea, A, we don't live long, we suffer from more diseases, and even the wealthiest don't escape. I think we can say that pretty strongly.
I was also curious about the carceral system, because that also sticks out for the United States in terms of how many people we incarcerate. And I'd heard a statistic, I swear the other day, it was like something about taking 3 years off your life if you've spent a year in the carceral system or something like that. But I don't know much about it, so I was curious if that came up in your research for the book.
So to begin with, we house a quarter of the world's prisoners. You know, our population is 4% of the world. And this started in the late 1970s. Before that, we weren't a carceral state. So 1 in 100 Americans is in jail. Our Declaration of Independence gives us the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The life, as I pointed out, is not a long one. Liberty is an illusion with 1 in 100 Americans behind bars. And yes, we're pursuing happiness, but happiness measures show us falling further and further behind. And actually, I haven't talked about gender differences, but women are seeing much greater drop in well-being than men. So 1 in 100 Americans is behind bars. If you're African American age in the 20s, male, it's 1 in 10 or 1 in 20. Now, why do we lock up so many? There's a few people have voiced, well, punishing the poor. A sociologist at Berkeley titled his book that way. You know, we actually do lock up poor people. You know, the banksters never went to jail. And this will continue. I mean, ideally, we should be locking up the banksters rather than poor people. And there's a big movement to even do away with jails. Having lived in Nepal for... there were no jails there, really. I mean, I eventually found one and photographed it. Most of Nepal is rural, and people take care of their own problems their own way. I would be for doing away with not only jails, but reforming policing, too.
Great talk. One of the things that's most disturbing to me, and probably to you, too, is how many Americans have become Trump supporters, and how... that the rise of autocracy here, as in other countries, is actually driven by voters, not by military takeover. Talk about all of those voters. Do you see a path to reconciliation? Do you see a way to build common ground? Do you see a way to decrease the polarization that we're facing now?
Complex question, but the Trump supporters are disproportionately poorer whites. You know, it's sort of like the deaths of despair. Either you kill yourself or you vote for Trump. and the rich and powerful are using this as a way to divide this country. If we could make the rich and powerful realize that they die, that they pay a very high price for living in America, that would be, we'd be making some progress there. You know, the rich and powerful don't number that many, but as I said, they're not the longest lived by far, and the studies don't put them there as well. In many ways, this country has many of the remnants of a failed state. And I think the fact that we have this tremendous political polarization is not healthy. Thanks again, and I'm sorry to depress you so much.
You were just listening to Dr. Stephen Bezruchka, Inequality Kills Us All. He spoke in Seattle. Dr. Bezruchka is on the faculty of the Department of Global Health and the Department of Health Services at the University of Washington. He's the author of Inequality Kills Us All. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 37th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To get copies of today's program, Stephen Bezruchka, Inequality Kills Us All, and for his book with the same title, Inequality Kills Us All, just call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us at 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. Series theme music is performed by the Kronos Quartet from Pieces of Africa.